idea of the infestation impact without any qualitative bacteria. Bacteria, I think, are a better analogy in a way, because you have useful bacteria and not useful bacteria and positively disastrously harmful bacteria. And I think you would say the same with memes, the good, bad, and indifferent ones. So, for Dennett, a person is an animal infested with memes. But there have not been many strong proponents of memetics. You can get on the internet, of course. Someone said to me the other day that memetics has got more swearing than memetics in it. And I don't know how much of value is embedded in the large quantities of stuff. But if you start looking up meme in the index of books, you won't find it very often. Now, getting into this area, I've been reading a lot of books recently on evolution, the origins of language, the origins of mind and of morality. Books like Dunbar's Grooming, Gossip and the Origins of Language, Pinker's... pardon?
Language.
Thank you, The Language Instinct. Tudge's The Day Before Yesterday. Mifflin's book on, well, come on, the history of the mind. You can give me all the time, it'll be a test. Okay, who are we going to have next? Right. Yeah, very good. Cronin. Quick, come on, you know that one? Yay. Ridley. Which one? I was thinking of The Origins of Virtue, not The Red Queen, but thank you for mentioning both. Now, of all those books, pardon? Oh, which Ridley? Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, well, Matt. In all of those books, The Ant and the Peacock is the only one where a meme appears with one entry in the index. Clearly, the word meme has not been such a brilliant meme, at least in by that measure. Well, perhaps I'm making a fuss about the word. Perhaps the basic idea of a meme is it is everywhere and people just don't like the name. Is this true? Well, there's clearly been a lot of work, the evolution of culture, in those 20 years. I could grossly oversimplify, of course, say that all of that work is on a kind of continuum. At one end of the continuum, well, no, of course, at the very end of the continuum, is Stephen Jay Gould, who says, I wish people would stop talking. I'm sorry, he doesn't speak like that, does he? But that's how I speak when I read his book. That's his latest book, Full House. I wish people would stop talking about the evolution of culture. Culture doesn't evolve, it just changes. It's nothing like evolution, it's nothing to do with it, it's completely different, and people are stupid if they use that word. So, cultural change, if you are a Gouldian, cultural change is okay, cultural evolution is not. Stepping onto the continuum, at least for a bit, you might see most of sociobiology as towards that end. If you like, you could use Wilson's image of genes keeping culture on a leash. The culture may evolve, culture genes and what have you, but it's kept on a leash by the genes. Moving slightly along the other way, there are people like Cavalli-Sforza and Feldman and Boyd and Richardson who've developed wonderful schemes, including such concepts as cultural fitness and talking about the ways that cultural units are passed on. And even further, perhaps, Durham with his co-evolution. Now, Durham goes as far as to say, as to give examples in which particular memes being adopted, particular cultural practices, will actually drive genetic evolution. One example he has is in lactation practices, driving the digestive processes. But all of these people, I believe, could be criticised the way Richard Dawkins criticised them originally in The Selfish Gene. He said, the trouble is, many of my colleagues, when it really comes, I don't forget the exact words, when it really comes to the point, when you get to the rub, when you, whatever it is, you know, at the end of the day, they fall back on biological advantage. And all of those people do. Even Durham, who I think is the furthest out and is the only one to use the word meme, his theory of co-evolution ultimately comes down to inclusive fitness as the final arbiter. And certainly, Richardson and Boyd, when they talk about maladaptive or adaptive cultural features, they mean adaptive or maladaptive for the genes. So I think we can see that very, very few people are prepared to take the idea of the meme as I believe it was originally intended, that is, as an independent replicator taking off on the back
of the first replicator, that is the gene. Now, I obviously want to have a go at treating the gene as a replicator. 20 years on, I feel that I have to justify the idea that the meme is a replicator before I can even begin to show that it's useful and how we may use the idea. So I'm going to spend a little while doing that job of justification. So, is the meme a replicator? Well, what do you need for something to be a replicator? We could go back to Dawkins' statement about all evolution being due to the differential survival of slightly inaccurate self-replicating entities. Are memes differentially surviving slightly inaccurate self-replicating entities? Well, I think they are. I mean, think of all the billions of memes that I'm throwing out every day. By memes, I mean potentially copyable actions. I'm rabbiting on half the time. It's amazing how many of my brilliant ideas don't get picked up by anybody. It's amazing how many of those wonderful concoctions people put in works never get made again and don't make it onto the television programmes to tell you how to concoct wonderful things in works. How many awful tunes do we hum to ourselves and, to our surprise, nobody picks them up and keeps humming them for the rest of the day? The world is full of far more ideas, actions, thoughts, words, deeds than can possibly find homes in more minds. Well, is that enough for them to be a replicator? I think so. If you want to be a bit more formal, you can say we need heredity of some sort, copying, replication. We've got that. Things are copied. We need variation. Oh, there's certainly variation. I'll tell you a story and the Chinese whispers will change. And we need not enough room to go round. We need selection. Yes, there's not enough room to go round. We cannot possibly process all those faxes and all those email messages and all of this stuff. Most of them disappear. As I've already pointed out, I think the definitions are very close. The meme is an instruction for producing behaviour stored in the brain and passed on by imitation, just as the gene is an instruction for producing proteins stored in a cell and passed on by reproduction. A very close analogy. Well, maybe that's not good enough. There are some very cogent objections to the idea that the meme is replicated, and I'd just like to consider three of them. Memes are not like genes. No, memes are not like genes. And I hope I've already explained why that doesn't matter. We are perhaps best to see the process of replication, what Dennett calls the algorithm of evolution, as the fundamental process, of which genes are one example and memes are candidates, at least, for being another example. But in what ways are they not the same, and it might matter? One possibility is that they're just not copied accurately enough. People say, well, you know, genes are really precisely copied. You know, there's an order of bases and it's copied exactly with very precise machinery and you only get occasional random errors and it's got to be as precise as that. Well, it hasn't got to be as precise as that. You can look at the thing as a kind of a range, if you like, kind of trade-off. If copying is absolutely 100% accurate, you cannot have any evolution. Everything will stay the same. And there's nothing for selection to work on, so you won't get any kind of evolution. If you have really sloppy copying, really, you know, hopeless, then okay, you've got masses of variation, plenty of variety for natural selection or mimetic selection to work on. Well, where's the problem? The problem, of course, is that if that sloppy copying throws up a good trick from time to time, it's as likely to be lost in the next generation as to be retained. And so evolution doesn't proceed very effectively, and it loses most of what it gains. Somewhere in between, there must be a range of accuracies of copying, which will get the process of evolution going. I think we would be wrong at this early stage in mimetics to say that we know that we're not within that range. My guess is that with most of the memes around at the moment, we are somewhere in that range, and it would be very, very interesting to find out just what differences it makes, how precisely the copying works. Probably it works everywhere in the range. We're probably not far from being able to sing, I don't know, Beethoven's Ninth. Anyone like to burst into song?
pretty accurately now, a very long time after it was written. Other ideas get distorted dreadfully. The idea of the poodle in the microwave. How many of you have heard the idea of the poodle in the microwave? About a third. How many have heard of something else in the microwave? What was it? A cat. Oh, no, not a cat. Oh, please let it be a poodle. I don't want it to be a cat. Any other advances on cat? Buttery guard in the microwave. Rotten. Frog. That doesn't work. The frog. And nobody put a pet frog in the microwave. The story for those poor people who haven't had this meme yet is that some American, rich American woman was drying her poodle. It's got to be a poodle because she's terribly rich and she washes her poodle every day and she bought a new microwave and she always used to dry her poodle in the oven. So when she gets the microwave, she puts her poodle to dry in the oven. And turns on, fries its liver, and no more little buggy. One version of the story has it that she sued the manufacturer for not putting a warning on it to say, do not put your dog, poodle, cat in the microwave. And won, you know, have $1 billion one wins these days for post-traumatic stress disorder. Anyway, that has been inaccurately copied. How accurate does it need to be? I don't know. I would guess that the accuracy interacts with another variable that I'll talk about in a minute, which is the speed of transmission. You may be able to get away, you may be able to trade off speed and accuracy. Familiar mass, probably there. Now, where else is it different? Well, the old killer, well, it's Lamarckian, isn't it? If it's Lamarckian, it's got to be bad. Now, of course, by Lamarckian, I mean it's max of the inheritance of acquired characteristics. Now, looked at first sight, meme transmission looks obviously Lamarckian because Andy, do something. That wasn't very good. That's better. Okay. I can do it too. Now what's happening? Do it again. Right, everybody do it. Oh, lovely. I should have had a camera to take a picture of you. Right, so what's happened? It's fascinating to think of the fiendish complexity of something that we as humans take for granted. And I think above all, this is something that keeps striking me, how we do take it for granted and how we don't even realize that the capacity to imitate is way ahead of the capacity to learn in other ways. Anyway, I like to look at it as a kind of reverse engineering, if you like. Andy's gone. I've looked at that, my perceptual system has analysed what's going on in some way, and the sort of job it's got to do, and I don't think we know how it does it, is to imagine, as it were, okay, he's done that, what would it take in here for me to do something which to somebody else would look the same as if he did it? Now you require theory of mind, you require, you know, other viewpoints, all the sorts of things which some of the primates have to some extent, but a large extent, some of them, and we have to a great extent. Have you noticed how, if you go up to a baby, or you know, what do? But they will blink back. If you blink at a baby, on the whole, they'll blink. And if you go like this, you know, what happens if you blink at a cat? What? They respond, but they don't blink. They respond, you know, with enthusiasm. They respond with wagging their tail or swishing their tail or perhaps batting at you if you do it enough. Well, you know, bat your face. They respond, but they don't copy. Whereas right from very early on, babies just seem to be copying things. They just, you know, they do a lot of it. Now, I mustn't get carried away with this. The point is that appears to be completely Lamarckian. It appears as though he's producing a behaviour and I am copying the behaviour. There is no, as it were, direct transmission of the meme from his brain to mine. But then I wonder how direct is the transmission of gene to gene in any case. I'm not sure what the word would mean. And I have also some stronger reservations about just uncritically accepting this criticism that it's obviously Lamarckian. First of all, let's suppose I've got a sore throat this week. And I'll tell you a really juicy story. Do you know who Adam went off with? Well, I tell you, you know. Well, you go off to tell your friends. You don't go, you know, you speak in a normal voice. Language is remarkably resistant to the vagaries of accent and sore throats and other things. You know, you get the gist and you pass that on. Or if I fall over while I'm demonstrating to you my new fancy combined garden hose and cat's umbrella. I love cats, really. I don't know why I'm picking on the poor things. If I fall over while doing that, you know, you're not going to think falling over is an essential part of using this thing when you decide to turn it on me. You are able to copy the essence of things without necessarily all the vagaries that go along with it. But perhaps more important as an argument against it, it's got to be Lamarckian, is to consider whether we are talking about phenotypes, or the equivalent of phenotypes or the equivalent of genotypes here. And we have to be very, very careful in translating these terms from one to the other. Dawkins says he says so many things in those few pages, that the memes are still floating around in their primeval soup, and Webb, Richard's here somewhere, says something the same with his fossil soup idea. But we haven't yet got to the stage of having well-defined phenotypes, or the equivalent of. They're still just kind of free-floating single replicators almost, or maybe in loose groups, but it's not quite the same. Now, you can rejig the whole scheme, I've tried to do this, such that you see the brain as the replicating machinery, which is doing the equivalent of the cellular replication of DNA, and we haven't got an equivalent of the phenotype to be the thing which would be Lamarckian, which would be altered. You could, if you like, say that the self was the phenotype. And you could say, but selves are not passed on. There'll never be another me, or you. And what happens to change you as a person is not passed on either. What's passed on are individual behaviours, individual needs. And in that way, it isn't Lamarckian at all. So I think I would personally hold back on deciding whether it's Lamarckian or not, and whether that matters. Finally, this is the question of speed. And full on memes are not like genes, and saying no, they're not. They're faster, yes, of course they are. To think about speed, I like to think about Dennett's Tower of Generate and Test. Do you know that? In Darwin's Dangerous Idea? How many people have read Darwin's Dangerous Idea? Few. Look, I'll explain the tower. Okay, the first level of the tower, nice ground floor here. This is full of Darwinian creatures. They compete with each other. Their bodies are the competition, if you like. And after a while, when they're a few billion years gone by, and plenty of Darwinian creatures, you'll start to get to creatures that can learn. Learning becomes a very useful trick. I suppose this is in some way related to the Aldrin effect. You have here more window. On the second layer of the tower, you have the Skinnerian creatures. Now, Skinner was well aware that learning is a kind of selection. In Dennett's terms, when you're a Darwinian creature, generating test means get born and die. Most of you die for a few successful ones to carry on. It's slow, it's inefficient, it's pretty expensive, it takes billions of years. But you get to be a Skinnerian creature, you don't just have to live and die, you can behave, and you can select the behaviours. So you try something out, makes you feel bad, and have an inbuilt, approach avoidance system, and if it triggers the approach, yeah, you do it again, if it triggers the avoidance, you don't. So you're a Skinnerian creature. Then comes another clever move. Third level of the tower. You don't actually have to try the behaviour. What if you just imagine the behaviour? Instead of actually jumping over that river and not knowing whether you'll actually have a long run to get to the other side, you think, last time I know, well, not quite that, but you can imagine yourself jumping, and you hold back, or you think, yeah, I can do this, and if you do that, you are a Popperian creature. And finally, and it's actually quite interesting to think which creatures are which. There's probably a lot more Popperianism around than we realize, which is sort of a good one. And finally, I'm too little to put the top low level down, you can have a radio beacon on the top of the night. Top level of the tower come the Gregorian creatures. So named after my previous mentor, Richard Gregory, because Richard once said, if you give somebody a pair of scissors, you increase their intelligence. When we pass on a tool to somebody, we are giving them the ability to learn from our mistakes. And we talked about the greatest mind tools being words, so that when we give somebody language, we are giving them all kinds of abilities that they couldn't have got, either by just being born and died, or by learning by themselves, or by being able to internalise their learning. They have to get it from somewhere else. Now, Dennett doesn't say so, but we could, if we like, say, up is on the flagpole. This is the tower, this is the level of the memes. That's where the memes get going. And And if Dawkins is right, they are a new replicator, and they will take off, and it'd be a heliport, couldn't it? And they could set off into the sky on the top of the heliport. Now, the point where I'm on about this at all is speed. It speeds up very dramatically. And once we get to the means, of course, we're going at the speed of light. We're going at the speed of all those little electrons whizzing about in email messages and at the speed of sound, more simply, when we talk to each other. So, or the speed of news, you know. The news that Fergie spent £1 million on a family holiday must have got to a few million brains within a few hours of some journalist finding it out or making it up. So, it's quick. Yes, I agree. Memes aren't like genes. Fine. I reserve judgment on how much that matters. I think the similarities and differences will be very important, and we don't yet know what they are and which ones will be important in which ways. I look forward to finding out if other people take up memetics and do something with it. So, on to number two. I can tackle numbers two and three as objections much more quickly than the others. We don't know the unit of the meme. No, we don't. We don't know how big is a meme. Is it na 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 na, or is it the whole thing? You know, is it one word or a story? You know, is the pool in the microwave a meme? Well, who knows? I don't know. But then we don't know for genes either. I mean, nature does not provide ready-made genes. It's perhaps easier to say that for certain purposes a certain length of code is really what counts. But, again, Dawkins is very, very clear about this in the selfish gene and in extended phenotype and elsewhere, that there isn't a precise answer to the question, how long is the unit of a gene? But I don't think that need worry us. Finally, we don't know how memes work. No, we don't. We haven't a clue. I've said something about how fiendishly difficult it must be. Imitation is not an easy process for living creatures to do. It isn't something that AI has even begun on. That's a topic for another lecture. But I would at least say that I don't think AI is going to get anywhere until the robots learn to imitate each other. But the point is, we don't need to know how they work. We could speculate, if you like, in terms of long-term synaptic potentiation. We can speculate in terms of altering weights and neural networks. There's all kinds of possible speculations of the physical basis. I'm quite content to say there's got to be a physical basis. I mean, we know enough to say that. We're not in the days of people saying, well, there can't be an engram, and, you know, philosophers, reasonably enough, you know, saying that there couldn't be. We know, for example, if I decide to do this, and I have electrodes on my head, we would see a readiness potential starting up in the motor cortex about 100 milliseconds before the action. That readiness potential is all the preparatory processing needed to get ready to do that. And the more complex the action, the more complex the readiness and the longer the readiness potential. If a pianist sits down at a piano and goes bang, very short readiness potential. If they're getting ready to play Herman Light Sonata. Well, and that begins now. I hear it often enough from my daughter's piano practice at 7 in the morning. But however it begins, there's a long readiness potential. Something is happening in there. We know there's a basis. There's stored instructions for producing that behaviour that produced it. We don't know how it does it. I don't think it matters that we don't know how it does it. After all, they didn't know from 1859 until the grand synthesis that genetics was going to be the basis for understanding biological evolution. I think those are excuses for not trying with memetics, and I want to try. I have a method for my trying. Means we can possibly find homes in those brains, which are more likely to find a safe home and get passed on again. Now, I've got a whole lot of brains on there, which I was going to draw on, but I can't do it on there, so I'll have to draw them on the board. I'll put the brains up in a minute. Here's some brain. I'm not very good at drawing brains, and there's another brain, and there's another brain. Quite a lot of brains. Now, imagine some memes. Imagine, you know, what sort of memes do you want? Songs, stories, that doesn't matter. Now, they're all, you know, some of them are passing over and getting into another brain. Most of them are going, meow, splat, meow, splat. Yes, but this poor person never gets his ideas taken up. This person's useless. Well, I guess well into that a few. And here, this one's here. They're swapping back and forwards loads. All they have to be in love, these ones. Right. So, all these memes going everywhere, which ones are going to carry on? This is the question. Basically, the general method, if you like, that I'm going to adopt. I need to be careful. I want to remind myself. I want to remind myself of three things. One, consider only the interest of the meme. Don't get sidetracked and be like Dawkins's derided colleagues who always fall back on biological advantage. Not interested in biological advantage, not relevant. Consider only the interest of the memes. Remember, memes have no foresight. Memes may give rise to an illusion of foresight in human beings, but they do not have a foresight. They are selfish replicants. And finally, beware of shorthand. The sort of shorthand I'm talking about is when I say things like, the memes want, or the memes try to, or it's good for memes to, or a good meme strategy is. I must be sure, whenever I say something like that, and you pick me up if you think it's not true, I must be sure I can translate that into a meme which does X will survive better than a meme which does not do X. Then I'm justified in saying, memes want anyway. So those are my warnings. Right, I'm ready. After all that preamble, I've got a little while left to do the job of persuading you. I didn't mean to say that. Far be it from me to start persuading anything. To try and tell you why I think we can do useful work with the idea of memes as independent representatives. I have a few, some brains I prepared earlier. Okay, here are my brains. Some are doing better than others. It's been on for 2 minutes. I gave them my life. So, remember the question, my view. You're now doing a room full of brains. And some of them need to be fostered by toes. Which means they're more likely to find a safe home and get passed on. This is mine with the back of the book, back of energy. Right. I've chosen 4 questions to tackle today. I didn't want to tackle too many. I wanted to take 2 easy ones to get us into the habit of thinking memetically, and 2 which I thought would particularly interest people here at LSE, the darling group, whatever you call your long-winded... the centre, that'll do, thank you. Okay, the first one, why do we think all the time? How many of you meditate or have ever tried to meditate? Oh, about 10%, even 20%. Okay, then you know what I'm talking about, don't you? You know that if you sit down in a nice quiet place with everything perfect and a nice cushion and you say, right, I'm going to sit here for 10 minutes and not think, what happens? Right. Masses and masses of ideas. Oh, I wonder if I should have said, oh, no, I shouldn't have done that. And, oh, I wonder if I'm going to have lunch tomorrow. And, oh, I mustn't think about that. Stop thinking. Oh, I can't do this. I'm useless. At this. Oh, I'm doing that. Well, I haven't had a thought. Oh, God, that must be a thought. Such like that. Oh, why do we do this? Wouldn't it be nice just to sit down and not think? Well, the answer is very obvious. Look at it like this. Let's compare 2 sorts of memes. On the one hand, a sort of meme which gets itself rehearsed in your head. A sort of meme that somehow just, you know, a jolly tune that goes on and on and on. Perhaps a sort that sort of goes back to the beginning again and so you never get to the end, it sort of goes round and round. Or a little idea that's just so, you know, just gets you somewhere so that you just can't help thinking it. Or a little sort of story that just tickles your fancy a bit and you just keep thinking about it, or whatever it is. That sort of meme is going to hang around. We know that rehearsal aids memory, so it's going to get stuck more firmly in your memory. And if someone just happens to say, a penny for your thoughts, or give us a tune then, Give us a tune then. Anybody? Pardon?
No.
No, sing one. Thank you. Very good. Happy birthday. Thank you. Okay, that'll do. I think ones that begin with sort of it's a lovely day, or you know, something will remind you of it. They tend to go around. Happy birthday, certainly will. But you know the sort of thing, they go round and round and round. Well, a meme that does that is going to be more successful than a meme that comes along, someone tells you something, isn't that interesting, it doesn't get your emotions, it's difficult to remember, it's difficult to say in your head, it's totally untune-like, doesn't go round. Which is going to win? The first lot. And what's going to happen? The memosphere is going to fill up with the first thought. And we all live in the memosphere, and our brains are going to come across those memes, and we're all going to get them. And what's the consequence of that? Our heads are going to be full all the time.
Of junk.
Of junk. Exactly. Now, does that ring true? The principle is familiar. It's only the same principle that leads trees to be tall in forests. Yes, there are other strategies for living in forests. You can be an epiphyte, you can be a creeper or a crawler, you can be a fern. But on the whole, being tall pays. And genes for being tall in a forest proliferate in the gene pool. And on the whole, forests are made of tall trees. Just the same principle. Okay, that's enough of why we think all the time. Let's apply exactly the same principle to why we talk all the time. Let us compare two sorts of memes. One sort of meme that just does compel you to tell somebody else. You know, that juicy bit of gossip or that wonderful idea or that funny story. Or something that's terribly easy to say and just trips off the tongue. Or something that really bothers you and you just think, I've really got to tell somebody about this one. Or whatever it may be. It doesn't matter what the reason is, a meme which gets itself said will spread faster than a meme that doesn't. It's so obvious. But when you say it's almost tautological. But then an awful lot of things in evolutionary theory are tautological. The trouble is, once you see them, you think it has to be true, and then I have the awful crisis and think, but it's not, it can't. You know. But I mean, it just seems to me so obvious that it has to be. And people who talk more will obviously spread more memes than people who do not, other things being equal. A meme of the sort, it's good to talk, or friendly people will always chat and have a, you know, stop and have a little chat. Or, you know, you really should always say, good morning, how are you? You know, don't just go, those memes will do better than memes that say, the way to be a successful person in life is to sit at home and never speak to anybody. That meme is not going to get anywhere compared with memes for networking for your business. So what is the consequence of that? On exactly the same argument, the memosphere is going to fill up with memes for talking a lot. And the consequence of that is that we're all going to talk a lot. Now, you could say that we talk a lot and think a lot for good biological reasons. Is it true? I don't know what the costs are. Thinking clearly carries some cost, although not a lot, since an idle brain is still using quite a lot of energy. It's certainly not using quite as much as an active brain is thinking. Talking uses quite a lot of energy. I've been seriously ill recently, and I realised that the first thing to go is chatting. You just do not chat when you haven't any energy. And the very process of articulation and all the arm rolling, all the smiling, I mean, all of that takes energy. Do we do it because we need the social contacts and so on for good biological reasons? Maybe, maybe not. Lurking in here is the distinct possibility. But what is happening is the memes are driving that brain for their own ends because of their own replicator power, quite regardless of the interests of the genes. Now this, I hope, lays the way for my more contentious suggestions which follow. Right, why are we so altruistic? Okay, we're not nice to each other all the time. Yes, we have wars, and that's another memetic story. We kill each other, and people get raped and murdered, and people have terrible rows. And yes, I know we're horrible to each other. On the other hand, that, you know, that's not really very surprising from a selfish gene point of view. What is surprising is that we are as altruistic as we are. Now, most biologists, I would say, most evolutionary psychologists in particular, and sociobiologists, are confident that in the end it will all come down to biological advantage. There are some wonderful popular books that explain this extremely well. Helena's is one of them. I've mentioned others. Matt Ridley's The Origins of Virtue writes them all. Anima. I would say those people think that ultimately human altruism can be explained in sociobiological terms. I'm not going to pass judgment on whether they are right or not. I'm simply going to offer an alternative, which is that human altruism is going to be explained not by biological advantage, but by mimetic advantage. Is it really such a problem? I think it is. Back to Dawkins again. Dawkins says that he is tempted to consider blood donating in England, where you don't get paid for it, as a case of pure disinterested altruism, whatever that might mean. In other words, he can't see any good biological reason why you would go away and give your own blood, which after all, you know, I mean, biological reasons is like you don't have a needle going in you and have blood taken out of you, for goodness sake. I mean, when you go to the hospital, they're not going to say, how many times have you given blood, or we won't give you any. And, you know, they do give you those little badges, but if you've been loads of times, but, you know, do you know anyone who wears theirs? I keep my little stickers sort of, well, like, it's put them in a drawer somewhere, I don't know. You know, I wouldn't wear my badge, I'm a blood donor, you know. Why are we doing this? Well, that may not be your favourite example. I wonder why we give money to people starving in faraway countries. They are very unlikely to share, they're likely to share as few genes with us as anybody on the planet, and we'll probably never see them, ever. Why do we do it? Because it makes us feel good. What does that mean? You know, ask yourself how well psychology will answer that. Or why are we so ecologically aware? And why do I recycle my bottles, for heaven's sake? I mean, you know, it's quite an effort. We have a special dustbin outside the back door, separate from the other dustbin, and separate from the compost bin, and carefully separate all the stuff. You know, why? And clear up after you on picnics, and hand in wallets you find. I mean, choose your own, it doesn't matter, you know, find your own example. There is a problem. Okay, what is the mimetic explanation of this?
Okay, imagine an apple of rain, and far more than into the pictures that we find homes.
Nice people will spread more memes. Let's imagine you're the sort of person who gives good parties, always buys around drinks, gives away your homemade marmalade, always has time to stop and chat if you're in trouble. You know, will give time to listen and help, you know. Those are the sort of people who will spread their memes. You want to talk to somebody nice, don't you? And you don't want to talk to somebody horrible. Therefore, it pays memes, one of my shorthands, I can translate it back, it pays memes to get into nice people. Any meme that can get itself into a nice person is more likely to spread than ones that gets into a horrible person. Unless they're a particularly powerful person, but that's another story. It's another way, it's another meme trick, which I'm not going into now. So, the same argument. Now, you may want to jump on any of those steps. You may want to say that, no, nice people don't spread more memes. Well, I'm glad to say that there is lots of evidence in social psychology and the psychology of persuasion to show that people are more likely to believe or take on ideas from people they perceive as friendly, attractive, nice people than they are from people they perceive as unfriendly or nasty or unattractive. Whether this is a cause or a consequence of a mimetic argument, I don't know. I think it might be possible that we could derive some of these very fundamental psychological principles directly from mimetics. Principles such as cognitive dissonance theory, the origins and need for self-esteem, and much of the persuasion, findings on persuasion. However, I'm not intending to make that claim here, I just raise it as a possible issue. In any case, it is reassuring to know that nice people do spread more memes, and therefore it is in the meme's interests to make people nice. That means what we're really saying here is that the memes, if they are truly independent replicators, will drive their carriers to pay the costs of being nice. Not for any biological advantage, but only for mimetic. Finally, I come to my last example. That is the question of why we have such big brains. Oh yes, I know, this is an old chestnut. There is a story going around, I don't know whether it's true, it might be like a dog in the microwave. Frog, cat. I think you were just deaf, it was dog and you thought it was frog. That's how memes get changed. the, I say this because I've never found anyone actually refer to any paper on this. It's in lots of books, but I don't know where it comes from. That the brain weighs 2% of our body weight and uses 20% of our body's energy. Well, I don't know if the figures are exactly right, but generally speaking, that has to be true from what we know about energy requirements of the brain. It's an enormously expensive organ to run, fantastically expensive. It's also enormously expensive to build. It requires an enormous lot of quite intricate and difficult proteins and a lot of fat for the man-in-chief and so on. It's expensive to produce. It is also very dangerous to get boring. It may or may not be a coincidence that the second replicator arose in a vertical walking bipedal animal, but certainly that doesn't give us a sort of pelvis that is just suitably designed for pushing out big brains. And it is not in the interest of the genes to have a huge brain that's going to cause a lot of babies to die after all that nourishment one at a time in the womb for a long time, or indeed to kill mother. There's something very funny going on here, but we require such a brain. People have calculated the encephalization quotient, that is how much bigger our brain is per body weight compared with other animals in the world. And if you compare us with other primates, our brains are about 3 times as big as they should be. That's bad enough. If you compare them with other creatures further down the tower, presumably, it rises to 25 times as big. I mean, our brains are huge. They're just way out of all, you know, they're just off the scale. There's lots of drawings, I'm sure some of you have seen them, scattergrams or whatever, of, you know, plotting brain size against body weight. And we're always kind of off somewhere, and people try and squeeze us back in by various clever arguments. Yes, there are some clever arguments. There are lots of theories around about how we got our big brains. Let me try and think of a few. I suppose the most common is that, you know, we needed to be that intelligent and big brains require intelligence. But think of the gap. Wallace, more than 100 years ago, said something like, why are we humans capable of poetry, art, mathematics, playing chess, you know, things so well ahead of our nearest relatives? I was particularly struck recently in reading some work about something else, that is, the demise of the Neanderthals. What happened to the poor Neanderthals now that we suspect that they're not our ancestors, but lived alongside our ancestors? Did our ancestors go and kill them all in some nasty bloodbath? We don't want that, do we? We want to be nice people, because our names make us want to be nice people. Well, various arguments suggest that only a small advantage would be needed for our ancestors to have won out over the Neanderthals. And a computer simulation, which I was reading about, suggested, and of course computer simulations have to put a lot of assumptions in and so on, but suggested that with a 2% advantage in intelligence terms over another hominid species, we could have wiped out the other species in less than a millennium. Now, if that is so, with a 2% advantage in a very short time, where on earth have we got this huge, a massive advantage? I think arguments along the lines of, well, you know, we just needed to be that intelligent to survive, I'm not going to say they're wrong, I'm just raising questions. But there are some more imaginative theories recently. Robin Dunbar argues that we got big brains in order to gossip, and that we need to gossip in order, well, the gossip is really, if you like, our form of grooming. But because our chosen way of making a living in the world is by having huge social groups, and we can't physically groom everybody else in our group, we have to gossip. And that gives a biological advantage to the need to gossip, which is expensive in brain terms. Richardson and Boyd argue with clever mathematics that at certain levels of ecological variability, of environmental change, social and individual learning will need to be very very good and require a big brain. Geoffrey Miller argues that our big brains were produced by sexual selection. Now, all of these are possibilities. I'm sure there are some other ones that I've missed out, but never mind. These are possibilities. I'm going to offer an alternative. Of course, this alternative is that the brains were meme-driven. I want to go back to my tower. Where's the nice yellow chalk on? Somebody has learn how to copy good tricks directly, mimetically. You're going to start being disadvantaged if you can't do it. Let me give you a concrete example. Let's suppose that somebody discovers how to make a flint knife, or somebody discovers how to make some kind of a basket to carry food in, or a pot to carry water in. If you can copy that person, okay, I have 2 minutes to go, thank you. If you can copy that person, you'll do fine. But if you are living in a group with lots of copiers and you can't copy, you won't get the food first because they've all got knives and you haven't. You won't get the precious water because they've all taken it away in their pots and you will be at a disadvantage. Now, of course, sexual selection may add to this. In such an environment, it would pay for the females to choose male mates who are good copiers. It's not essential to the argument, and I think it's an empirical question just how important that would be as well. The main gist of the argument is that once copying gets underway, once there are memes floating about in a group, there will be a biological advantage to those who can copy. Making the minimal assumption, that I think would be hard to challenge, that larger brains are better copiers, this will drive the increase in brain size. In other words, one replicator has forced the moves of another. And that is why I think we have our huge brains, and that, I believe, shows for the first time why we should have a brain that is just completely out of scale with all the other brains on this planet, because it is the only brain that sustains a memosphere, the whole world memes. Well, I promised you a few words on minds themselves. You will realise by now that I would say that the mind is the whole collection of memes that this particular brain has. We are animals infested with memes. But what about me? What about the real me? What about this little person in here? What about the one who does it all, that makes the decisions, the one who lives my life, the one who feels my feelings, the one who experiences my experiences? Well, I would say that just like Dawkins's religions, this is just a co-adapted meme complex. Just one of the many groups of memes living in this brain. Just like religions and cults and political systems and so on. It's massively well protected, it has all sorts of mechanisms for keeping itself safe. It's a good safe haven for ideas to get into. Selves will fight for their own ideas. They have opinions and beliefs and they will fight for them. Good place to be. And, like religions and cults and political systems, it doesn't have to be true. Indeed, it's not true. We know if you open up the brain, you only find neurons. You don't find the place in the middle where it all comes together. You don't find the little homunculus pulling the strings and experiencing the experiences. There's only neurons. There's nobody in there. In other words, all I am is a co-adapted meme complex rocking about amongst the whole of other ones in this brain. No wonder the very word of memes makes me need to have scare coats and give a little bit. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have 20 minutes available for questions. There are a few memes which are appropriate for question periods in the seminars that we have. When you ask a question, could you please tell us your name and where you're from, and also speak up? This is acoustically not a terribly good lecture theatre for audiences. I think it was probably designed that way so that students couldn't speak back too much. One of the pleasures of chairing occasions like this is that one gets to launch one's own memes at the speaker first. And
what are my severest critics this?
I'm not fully persuaded by the meme idea. Something you said made me want to ask you the following. You said that when we're ill, one of the first things that we stop doing is chatting because of the energetic costs. My question is this: if your idea of independent memes is correct, shouldn't it be the case that when we're ill, we chat more, and if we're mortally ill, we will chat even more because the memes should be very anxious to get out? So it seems to me that what is actually true, our natural tendency to talk should be exaggerated rather than reduced when we're ill.
That
that would be my answer. They can't see the future. So the memes are not little thinking engines going around saying, oh, she's going to die, I've got to get into a new host. If we were talking about genetic evolution, we would have a background, it would have in the past paid genes, if you like, to have the ones which were able to do that kind of foresight and see that when a person's going to die, they've got to hop it. That would work, but it won't work in that way for memes. And in any case, I think the reason that I was raising this issue about when you're ill is just to ask in my own mind the question, what is the cost of talking? Because I was stepping towards the idea that it is surprising that we talk so much. Because I think on the whole we don't think of it as very surprising, we think we talk for very good reasons. But there's two ways of looking at this. One, we talk a load of rubbish, frankly, don't we? Chatter about garbage, which Dunbar explains is necessary gossip. And two, does it actually have a cost? Yes, I think it does, it uses some energy.
Yes, please.
First of all, is any reason that before you use it all being kind of same units? I would thought it might be quite consistently considerably different.
Could you say who you are?
Sorry, my name is Principal, I don't know your public. And about the Proterianism, was that any correlation of arboreal life? It was pretty tough that you leave it down the street. You kind of fall to have any trial there rather than you fall to the ground.
Well, yes.
If you
by some measures we are, but you could say that everything that is alive at the moment is successful by virtue of being here.
Yes.
And you could say that our life has been extremely short so far and we may well end it,
yes.
In which case we will not, under some measures, be as successful as many other things. So I don't really buy that argument. Your other points about the Popperian creatures, an awful lot of mammals and some amphibians and all sorts of other animals are Popperian creatures capable of thinking before they act. Crows can do quite interesting tasks by simply observing the environment and seeing what needs to be done and doing it. They can get food by using tricks and so on. So we are certainly not alone at all in being Popperian. There are lots and lots and lots of Popperian creatures. We appear to be alone in having really good imitation skills. Imitation amongst other mammals is confined to quite small, quite simple kinds of imitation. And some of the most famous types of memes in animals, I mean, one of the most famous is the blue tits pecking the top of the bottles. But it's quite interesting that they are not copying the whole action. And it could be done by very simple following and with learning. They peck anyway, it's something that they do. And if they followed another bird and pecked it in a similar place, and then they discovered it tasted good, they'd do it again by learning. So I think we are alone in having the kinds of imitation skills we have.
Yes.
Can I make a point? Sorry, I'm
Nick Ray,
I'm a research.
And he started me off, well he didn't start me, I read Dawkins years ago, but he kicked me into this.
I'm coming back on the talking question. Surely it must be a genuine visual state of strategy. If you talk yourself too much, then talk yourself to death, which means you may miss out on 20 years or so of being able to talk and spread memes. So the memes that don't talk you to death presumably will survive longer. However, if they don't talk at all, then of course they're not going to spread the memes either. So I think it comes down to an individual state of strategy.
Yes, that may well be right. And I would love to see people doing the maths on all this kind of thing. I mean, some of these payoffs are going to be very interesting. When I first started talking about this stuff a few months ago, I think it was Helena who said, we're talking too much, you know, people who talk too much are a pain in the neck, you don't listen to them. So I looked into some of the social psychology evidence, and in fact, people who talk fast are believed more than people who don't, which is very interesting. I thought, well, that's a clue. But obviously, there are going to be strategies that work and ones that don't, and I think you're right about that.
Professor Dawkins.
One of the things that's most worrying, I think, is the lack of high fidelity, and you did touch upon that. But there are what look like self-normalizing procedures for keeping fidelity on track. If I make a sculpture, which you then copy, and then somebody else copies, and somebody else copies, then it degenerates in no time at all. That's a Chinese prism. But if I make by origami, folding paper, a the equivalent of the sculpture. Because in origami there are rules like fold to the living, fold back.
Yes.
As it's imitated, if somebody does it badly, the mistakes don't get passed on. The rules themselves are self-normalizing. Now, I wonder whether language itself is self-normalizing that kind of way.
Yes, I think it is.
I mean, words in particular, although the accent changes as the Chinese whispers go down, although the all sorts of things may change, nevertheless, words are a kind of anchor that keep us, that maintain more fidelity than we had any right to expect.
Yes.
And I wonder whether you think that's
right. I think that's absolutely right. I think that you're amplifying, really, I think, on what I said with that example of having a sore throat, that you ignore those things and you try to get to the gist of it. I liked your example about the statue, because you see, if you, did you say statue or sculpture, thank you. If it were a kind of weird, strange sort of sculpture and I tried to copy it, I wouldn't do very well. But let's suppose that you made a statue of Chairman Mao or a statue of Maggie Thatcher or something. And I looked at it, I thought, oh wow, that's a really cool statue of Maggie Thatcher. I want one of those. I'm going to make one out of the same stuff. I've seen so many pictures of her that I think it wouldn't matter that I couldn't copy it very well. I'd get, someone else would then realise it was a statue of her. And that would be one of your self-normalising things, I think. In as much as we share a cultural community of ideas, we may take some instantiation, like a sculpture or a song or a sentence, to be a representation of something, and we try to copy that, the idea that we think is being put over, rather than the expression of it. So I think you're right. I don't know what we can do next with that, but I think that would help a lot in increasing the
awareness. Well, self-normalizing mechanisms have been evolved themselves.
Yes. But you see, it trades off with speed. See, if the thing goes very, very quickly, you can afford for it to be a bit sloppy. You can afford to lose a lot on the way, and I don't know how that trade-off will work. You can keep trying again if it doesn't get through, because you've got a lot of time, and you haven't got to die in the process.
Yes, please.
So, George, the way you describe the replication, I think the good example is to say it's really, I mean, you can find it today in Eastern Square, Now, if that's the case, and if it doesn't mean, then what is it to distinguish it from a religion or
not? Oh, a very good question. What is there to distinguish E equals MC squared from a religion?
That wasn't the question.
No, I know what the question is. It's really the same question that Andy's been asking me and kindly didn't ask me today, about truth. It's quite easy to talk about untrue memes going around, but is there any kind of truth? Are there better memes than others? I'm jumping a bit from your question, but I think this is what's implied there. I personally would say that science is different from religion, that scientific theories have something that religions do not have. And those some things are, well, I suppose you could say they're Popperian, depending on your view of the philosophy of science. But you can test scientific ideas, and you can make hypotheses from them and do experiments and see whether they work or not, which you cannot do with religions, and that makes all the difference.
But that's my premise.
Mm-hmm.
That's my premise.
Yeah.
And my question is, but if it's just me, then how can I distinguish the theory of that? I mean, I do think scientific theories to be distinguished
examining very contested. You say it's just a meme. Is there a meme? Is some unimportant thing one can say, well, it's just a meme, so ignore it.
No,
it's a
sorry,
meme.
But it's a meme in the sense of derivation.
Yes, it is. I agree.
If it is in the same sense, then why do I have this idea that I can actually distinguish it properly in the sense that I can test it?
Because of the behavioral consequences. All memes produce behavior by definition. The kinds of behaviours that religions produce are the sorts of behaviours that will carry that religion into more people, and their only function, their only effect is self-replication. Whereas the effect of scientific ideas can be to knock them out. In fact, that is really one of the major processes of science, is that a meme can act to produce behaviour, experiments, surveys, whatever it is, which will change the mimetic basis in a way that never happens in religion. That's the difference, I would say.
I'd like to ask you is,
I love theories that explain everything. I've always been tempted by them, which is why I spent 25 years of my life searching for the paranormal, because after all, if the paranormal exists, it can explain everything. So it could be, may well be, that I will come to the same conclusion about this. I don't think it's wrong to like ideas that explain things. So the fact to me that through thinking about this, I feel that I can explain, or I have this wonderful sense of things falling into place, is a justification. It's not enough, but it is something. As for predictions, oh yes, I've been racking my brains about predictions. I have not yet got the precise experiment, the knockdown, crucial one. If memetics is true, this will happen, and if it's not true, it won't happen. But then we can't do that for evolutionary theory in general either. But no. But I can still make a few predictions. Let's take the altruism one. If it is true that, it's quite a strong claim, this one. What I'm claiming is that people will use resources, they will work or they will pay in order to spread their means. Now, we're used to the idea of people buying information that they want. We're used to people forcing information on other people in order to make them buy products, for example. But we are not used to the idea that people will pay or work simply to offload or get copied their own means. So we can set up social psychological experiments, for example, where we have some kind of measure of work or pay, tokens, mints, sandwiches, it doesn't matter what it is, people, social psychologists use all kinds of things. We set up some kind of experiment in which we can get people, give them ideas in situations where we can manipulate who's going to tell what to who. And I believe we will be able to show that people will actually pay to spread their useless ideas to other people.
I wonder how many academics would be prepared to pay for giving lectures rather than having a work.
Well, nobody's paying me to give this lecture, and I spent a long time preparing it, and I don't have a full-time job. I'm mad, but I do believe that's a good example.
Nigel Lewis, another business school. It seems to me that you've given a very good description of general selection theory applied at the well, one thing you said troubled me immensely was that the idea is not like, oh, that's the idea that means and means what.
Yeah.
I find this difficult to say whether I go back to school, I think it's going to be a school with an idea and it's
right.
You sort of turned, it seems to me you've turned the religion theory on the head, and you've argued, for example, the multiple that the idea that the idea of the head is not that idea of having
yes, that's precisely what I am claiming. This reminds me of, I must always remind myself of, beware of shorthand. It's one of those shorthands. When I say the memes have interests, I am using that as a shorthand for meme. Let's say it is in the interest of the memes to do X. It can be expanded to say memes that do X will survive better or spread to more hosts than memes that do not do X. That is what I meant by in the interest of the memes. Something that is in the interest of the memes is something that will help them to spread. What makes the difference between a meme and a tool is that a tool is not a replicator. A tool may be very successful in, unless you say that the idea of the tool, which is the meme, is. I mean, a particular tool, this particular example of a board rubber, doesn't have any interest because, you know, obviously it doesn't. But the idea of board rubbers, if you can see, because it's a replicator, the idea, what a fantastic board rubber, I mean, get rid of all these brains and red type. You see this, you go off and buy one yourself. Yeah, but that's not the point. That isn't the point. The question, when we're dealing with memetics, we have to put out of our head all that biological advantage. It gets in the way, we don't see the point. As Dawkins said 20 years ago, he's got to keep falling back on biological advantage. If you do that, you can't see the point about this independent replicator. But it is in the interest of this idea, in other words, meaning this idea of this board rubber will spread better if it does its job well, if it looks attractive, it's in a nice packet. That's all I meant by in the interest of, and I think that that is exactly what is meant in biology when we talk about something as being in the interest of the genes. Something that spreads a particular gene, it can be expanded into the wrong hand in the same way.
Yes, please.
It seems to me that social identity is given the most powerful means by ideology, religious or otherwise, very often extension. Statements also display that they are not scientific.
Yep.
In fact, most of the people that have been described religious people
yep.
don't really have much standing
I think you'd be in... I think you would be in the majority by saying that. I think you'd find a lot of people agree with you. And in a sense, that is not as nearly as controversial as the view that I'm putting here. In fact, when you come to religions, the interplay between the genes and the genes is very interesting. Dawkins has talked very clearly about this in his idea of religions as viruses of the mind. Now, they're not just mimetic things. It would be quite difficult to get a pure meme group going with no genetic handhold at all. Although I'm sure there are some. There are certainly some on the internet. I got one yesterday. Pass this on. This is a good luck thing, you know. But maybe even that's not pure. The way I like to look at it is this. Our brains are produced by the genes, and they have certain needs and desires. You know, awful angst about, you know, what's the point of it all? Or, you know, whatever it is, religions can get into that. Wanting somewhere, you know, to go after death. Wanting reassurance for our insecurity. Whatever it is, these biological sort of things are there in the religions. But the rest of the stuff does not need to have biological advantage. And some of the examples that Dawkins gives are, for example, spread me. It's there in the Catholic religion, absolutely. You know, it's good to get converts, it's good. Good, well, it's good. You know, go and kill all the infidels. That will have biological effects, but just persuade them. Believe ridiculous things. You know, believe in the Trinity. You know, this is not a piece of chalk. This is really the blood, the body of Christ.
Obviously.
Now, you know, it's not good enough just to believe that it's a bit like it, or it stands for it, or whatever. You've got to believe that it really, really is. Now, this is training you. This is part of the meme tricks. It's training you to believe completely impossible things so that you won't do the scientific trick of saying, well, I'll find out. I'll cut into it and see if it is. Right? And you won't do that if you're trained by these meme tricks. So the uncontroversial part is the part you said, yes, of course, there's some biological piggybacking because the second replicator is running on the first. But the interesting thing is when it takes off second.
Unfortunately, although I'm sure there are many, many more memes that it would be extremely pleasant to be able to exchange, there is something else happening in here at 6:30, and the messenger was just coming down. So I'm afraid we'll have to stop at that point, and thank you again, Sue, for a most stimulating session.